The Hong Kong Book Fair is greatly looking forward to seeing you. There's a lot of excitement about your coming to Hong Kong. I've, of course, met you in Hong Kong a few times. When was the last time you were in Hong Kong?
The last time I was in Hong Kong was, I think, January or February
So
this
you go
year.
quite often, in fact.
I go quite often, yes. For example, I go to China to see my mother.
Yes.
And I often transit.
Where does she live?
She lives in Chengdu, in Sichuan province. Yes,
yes, very good.
Yes.
Now, you became, I wouldn't say overnight, but almost overnight, a formidable figure with Wild Swan. Your book, Wild Swan, has sold millions and millions of copies and have been translated into many languages. How many languages have been translated into?
I think something like 37.
37?
Or
I didn't even know that there were 37 languages in the world. And that really defined your stature as a writer. Were you surprised when it became so successful?
You know, when it first came out, I didn't, I wasn't thinking about whether this book was going to be successful or not. And the reason was that I wrote the book as a result of my mother coming to London to stay with me in 1988. That was 10 years after I came to Britain. And for the first time, my mother told me the stories of her life and the stories of my grandmother. And when she started, she couldn't stop. She stayed with me for 6 months and she talked every day. And she left me 60 hours of tape recordings. And that's how I started. And when the book was finished, when I was beginning to worry about whether it would be a success, and my mother wrote and said, the book might not be a success and people might not pay attention to it, but I was not to worry because she could feel that writing the book had brought us closer together.
But
I had
not
made
only
her
closer
a happy
together,
woman.
But almost anybody alive at the time, because you managed to encapsulate a very closely knitted period of China that encapsulated the imperial China, the Mao era, and of course afterwards. What year was the book published, in fact?
1991.
A few years after Tiananmen Square.
Well, I actually, that wasn't, Tiananmen Square wasn't why I started
to
write
the
book.
But my question, what I was going to anticipate was that you started writing in 1989. I think Tiananmen Square was 1989, right?
Yes.
So you were actually writing it as Tiananmen Square unfolded.
Yes.
Did you feel you had to change anything, or did you just relied on those wonderful tapes that your mother gave you and just went on and just finished the job?
Actually, I was in China when Tiananmen was building up in 1989.
Yes.
I was in China traveling in Beijing, actually, and other places, and Chengdu, of course, researching Wild Swans.
Yes.
From my point of view, I was just writing a book about the history of my family, about the fate of these three women, my grandmother, my mother, and myself. But of course, we can't escape politics in China.
Yes.
And the history of China was always in the back of my mind. I was aware that I was also at the same time writing about the history of China in the 20th century. I did a lot of research.
Well, what I was trying to get at was that as Tiananmen Square happened and you were going to you were finishing off the book, let's say 3 or 4 years later, were there moments when you woke up in the middle of the night or one morning over a cup of tea, you suddenly thought, I'm going to change this. I'm going to write more about it, and I'm going to change my mind about saying what I was going to write. I mean, did that incident have any significant changes to the book that you were writing, if it hadn't happened, for example?
Well, Tiananmen is in the epilogue of Wild Swans. And my book ended in 1978 when I left China. Yes. So it was way before Tiananmen. It sort of provided a background to why Tiananmen happened. And you know, but just the background. But I wasn't writing a political book. I wasn't thinking about changing China. You know?
But how about Mao? That's as political as you can get. Now, what gave you the idea initially of writing this monster biography?
Right. Well, the thing is, after Wild Swans was published, and I was beginning to think about writing another book, Mao was obviously the obvious subject. He dominated my early life. I saw him turning the lives of a quarter of the world's population upside down. And yet I felt the world knew astonishingly little about him. And I wanted to find out more about him. And that's how I started writing. You know, John, I wrote the book with John, my husband.
John, yes, who is also at least an expert. I mean, he's an expert I know of Korea, for example. I read his book on Korea.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Very good.
Yes.
And on Russia. He knows Russian and he worked in the Russian archives. And in fact, he speaks many languages. And when we divided...
Not 37.
Well, perhaps not quite, but, you know, given time, I wouldn't be surprised.
But what year did you start researching on Mao and how long did it take you to finish that book?
We started in 1973.
Oh, I see.
No, I'm terribly sorry. In 1993. 1993.
So soon after you published Wild Swan.
Yes, there was a period, you know, of intense publicity and traveling.
Yes.
I also had a major operation. And then we started in 1993. And then John and I divided our research by language, because I'm Chinese, so I dealt with the Chinese language sources. And John speaks many languages, so he was landed with the rest of the world.
and how long did it take you? When was Mao published, finally?
2005. It took us 12 years to research. Yes, but those were the most riveting years of my life, because we caught a window of opening, of opportunity. In the 1990s, the Russian archives were open, and a lot of them have been closed. And that was an absolute treasure trove, because Russia, as you know, is practically
correct
on every page of our Mao biography. And then in China, I managed to get a lot of documents, and some archives were open, and also a lot of Mao's contemporaries were still alive.
Correct.
So we interviewed, you know, Mao's family, relatives, friends, colleagues, widows of colleagues, the staff serving Mao, and also Mao's friends, two going back to 1918. And one particular person was the first Communist Party member that Mao introduced into the party. So they went really way back. They were so helpful. And most of them spoke for the first time.
Yes.
And it was as though they were waiting for somebody to come and ask them questions.
And you felt that they were all candid?
As candidate as can be. Of course, I there were a lot of, some people were a bit worried, but we weren't asking them, how do you think of Mao?
Yes.
We asked them the details in Mao's life, and we pieced these details together to form a
jigsaw. Did you meet Dr. Li, who wrote his other biography about
himself?
No, we
made appointment to see him, but he died. Just before we reached him.
Yes. He was living in San Francisco or somewhere.
Yes, I've been to his place after his death.
Yes. But, I mean, with this golden opportunity, which obviously was a godsend, because I suppose in the 90s there was probably unleashed this great liberalism, and everybody worried much more about being a capitalist than a communist,
totally right.
Things were a bit more relaxed.
Mm-hmm.
Ironically, not so much now. There's always a reversion to that sort of state of affairs. You were very lucky in getting it. And when you say you were you riveted because you had this window of opportunity,
mm-hmm.
or were you riveted by the things you heard and found?
And I think both. We were riveted because we got to see so many historical figures. We interviewed many presidents, you know, prime ministers, foreign ministers, heads of communist parties and Maoist parties, not to mention these figures I talked about in China.
Who'd gone to see Mao, obviously. I mean, the foreigners who interacted.
Foreigners also, yes. No, Henry Kissinger, we interviewed several times. Edward Heath in this country, the Dalai Lama, and Imelda Marcos, and Mobutu. Do you remember this tyrant in Zaire? We of met course. Him in Hong Kong. Can I tell you how
yes,
the story,
absolutely.
How we met
how
him? It was absolutely riveting. The thing is, one morning in Hong Kong, after we did some research in China, we were in the Hong Kong hotel, and John was in the bathroom reading his morning local paper, South China Morning Post.
Yes.
And he suddenly yelled from the bathroom. He said, "Guess who's in this hotel? It's Mobutu." Because Mobutu had a special relationship with Mao.
Yes.
And John said, "Shall we try to find somebody to introduce us?" And I said, "Oh, John, you know, I can't be bothered. I've done 2 months interviews. I'm exhausted.
Yeah.
I'm going to the hair salon."
Yes.
So I went to the hotel hair salon. And 10 minutes later, who but Mobutu started in.
Well, in the same hair salon.
In the hair, same hair salon. And it was the regent in the hotel. And he was sitting, you know, all this like where you are. And he was under this hair thing. He had bits of cotton wool.
He had a perm.
He had a steam blown into his hair.
Yes.
He had bits of cotton wool around his head, bits of towels around his neck. He was trapped. So I approached him when I was led to have my hair rinsed and asked him for an interview.
Well,
and that's how we got
that's extraordinary.
In Hong Kong.
Well,
Hong Kong.
We, as in Archimedes shouting Eureka, so your husband shouted Maputo in the bath with very good consequences.
Yes.
But did you find that the Westerners' view of Mao were more insightful or less so than perhaps the Chinese who interacted with him? I mean, I always find that sometimes you find people who don't see others as much as possible tend to have an outside view, which is more illuminating. I mean, did you find that that people who saw Mao all the time and the people who spent time on the Long March or within his inner circle prejudiced in some way more than those who saw him occasionally, like the Kissingers of the world?
Well, I think that the Chinese in those days, they generally know much more about Mao than people in the outside world. With the people from the outside China, we never ask them what they thought of Mao. I mean, that's not what we're interested. We ask them what they talked to Mao about and how they made policies, made decisions.
Yeah. Because you were interested in Mao himself as to how he might have viewed or expressed his view or acted upon certain conversations or incidents and events.
We were interested in digging out facts, and we were going to put these facts together and reach our own conclusions. I mean, it was also riveting because of our discoveries. You know, in those 12 years, John and I were in our separate studies, and at lunchtime, we would get together and discuss our big and small discoveries. And it was absolutely riveting. And talking about the views about Mao, and of course, outside China, particularly in those days, you also had a lot of people who had illusions about Mao. And I'm very glad, I think that's largely gone. The mainstream West have come to realize that Mao was a monster in the league of Hitler and Stalin. And Mao's portrait doesn't belong to Tiananmen
Gate. Well, it is an extraordinary thing, but I suppose that nobody dares to do anything about it because they could open a can of worms. I mean, it is an extraordinary situation because quite clearly people openly criticize the Great Leap Forward and the Cultural Revolution, and yet the person responsible for it dominates in its regal position, the very center of China. But without going into into the contents of the book, when you finished the book and you published it, obviously with a sigh of relief and so forth, were you also happy with its reception?
We had wonderful reviews in the sort of mainstream press. We were also attacked by a lot of China academics.
Yes.
And my view is, I think a lot of them got interested in China in the 1960s, and they were enamored with the Cultural Revolution and with Mao, and they didn't want to see their kind of lifelong illusion being shattered.
Yes.
And of course, there was a lot of jealousy.
Yes. You
know?
Yes.
We discovered all these things they didn't know.
Yes.
I mean, you know, all that's
But
you
that,
know,
you see, is extremely interesting. Two things.
Mm.
Number one, you almost should tell people that if they want to become a writer, they could become an even more interesting one if they married another writer who spoke different languages, who can then embark on a joint operation. And every day, before lunch and after lunch, go to your respective rooms, mm-hmm. and then at the moment of rendezvous, you talk about these extraordinary things. I mean, that is an extraordinary life. Almost unique, I would say, except that I suppose in literary history the couples who I mean, philosophers Elizabeth Anscombe and Peter Geech, they were great philosophers, both writers. I can imagine them getting together at lunch and talking about it. That's extraordinary. I mean, the other thing is, of course, writing a book which is as huge as Mao, and getting a reception, and then also getting attacked and feeling the effect of the book on people.
Mm.
So everywhere you go, and I know that when I go with you, people remember Wild Swan, soon they will remember Mao very quickly. Mm. Do you get a buzz out of all these people who have read what you've written? And have you encountered any particular incidents that made you feel particularly pleased to have been an author?
Well, yes. I mean, going on Chinese website now, or since the book was translated into Chinese by me.
By you.
And it was published in Hong Kong.
Yes, published in Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
And I was saying that
yes.
Hong Kong is really unwittingly become an actual pearl of China.
Yes.
If you know, 35 million visitors through Hong Kong, as opposed to a population of 7 million, which for me is extraordinary because that means at any one time there are probably more mainlanders in Hong Kong than residents. And that will grow. And so within 10 years, we're going to talking about hundreds of millions of people who will come through, and they will Google, as I said to Eric Schmidt the other day, and they will do all these things which, thankfully, Hong Kong is still entirely free.
Yes.
And so you must regard Hong Kong as a very special place as an author who is critical about certain aspects of China that Chinese on the mainland might feel either jealous about or are prejudiced.
Well, I mean, yes, I mean, Chinese tourists now go to Hong Kong and Taiwan to buy banned books.
Paris, for
but particularly in Hong Kong and Taiwan, to buy banned literature, banned books. I mean, you know, our Chinese edition have sold many, many copies. Many have gone into China and have created such an impact. I mean, it's absolutely riveting on the Chinese web, and the people have picked up a lot of things that we were the first to say. I mean, for example, the reason for the famine for nearly around 40 million deaths between 1958 and 1961, and the reason had never been explained until, if I may say, as because Mao was exporting food to Russia and to Eastern Europe to buy a whole range of military factory industries and nuclear technology and equipment and the missiles and so on. And he exported food to pay for these purchases. And that point has been picked up by so many, you know, people in China. Yes. And the
sense of anger.
The people have picked up on that, yes, and they now have found an answer to their questions. And it's just quite riveting to see the impact of particularly the Mao biography in China. I mean, that's something that makes me most happy. And also the other thing is, you know, when the book was first published, when the academics, some academics were attacking us, people were expecting them to point out errors, the numerous errors they claim there were in our book.
Yes.
But how many years have gone past? Not a single error has been pointed out. And what's more, and people have found many other have dug out facts that supported or italicized our points. So I feel extremely happy.
But as a biographer, that has come about from meticulous research of 12 years multiplied by two with all sources and so forth. So your advice to any aspiring biographers, do your homework, because ultimately it is only the homework that will sustain the veracity and the popularity of your work.
Yes, David, I think do your homework, particularly go to primary sources.
Yes, primary sources.
Because many people recycling each other, and it was just, I mean, you know, if I may say, you know, the Cuban Commission.
Yes. Yes.
The report you gave me.
Yes.
That was a document that was not, that is not available.
Yes.
And it's a primary archive document.
Individual interviews to every single slave in Cuba.
Yes. Well, I mean, that has corrected some of the secondary sources. I mean, of course, this book is to your this report from you is to do with the Empress Dowager, my new book.
I want to mention that because we haven't got.
All right.
We want to hear you properly in Hong Kong. What gave you the idea of Empress Dowager, who is seemingly another monster?
Well, the thing is this: I knew nothing about her until I was researching wild swans, because my grandmother had bound feet, you know, the Chinese bound their women's, crushed and bound their women's feet to produce these ghastly golden, 3-inch golden lilies. And I was under the vague impression in those days that somehow the communists sort of banned it effectively or something. Until I realized foot binding was banned by the Empress Dowager in 1902. And so that got me quite interested in her. And then when we were researching Mao, I realized that Mao had an incredibly free childhood and youth. Mao was born in 1893 under the Empress Dowager. And when he was a young man, he was still under the Empress Dowager. And as a peasant lad, he had a scholarship offered to him. He had opportunities to go abroad. He could travel with a girlfriend, checking hotels. You know, he led a free a really free life, intellectually free as well, with the number of publications, the freedom of the press. And they were all under the Empress Dowager. And so after Mao, with some friends mentioned her, and I suddenly clicked, you know, she might be a good subject. Then I did some research, and then I found that she was condemned. Or by, you know, if you go on Google, you still see she was overwhelmingly condemned. I mean, that sort of doesn't fit with the little bit I already knew about her. So I found that, you know, she's definitely
she was a liberal leader. She actually banned bound feet and all these things. So were these the surprises that you were able to find in this case as painting a rather condemned character and perhaps making her look, or not look, but making us aware of the fact that she wasn't nearly as bad as she was found out to be with long fingernails.
Well, I mean, that was just the beginning, yeah, when I found out these things. I mean, it was 1908.
Well, obviously, I mean, her relationship with Puyi was a rather special one. And I've no doubt that that would figure in your book,
yes,
and so forth. But to her death, do you think that she was a sort of liberal leader in the context of China? I suppose
she most definitely. But of course, I mean, she's also a complex figure. I mean, she had many flaws. And this book is going to reflect.
What year did she die?
She died in 1908. She was born in 1835.
But then she was responsible for the ending of the Confucian system of examinations.
Yes.
That ended in 1905.
Yes.
So she also was a bit of a modernist, I suppose, for having stopped this tradition of 2,500 years.
Yes.
Which I hadn't,
yes,
really occurred. And those are the kind of riveting things that you find as a result of research, meticulous research, doing
your
homework.
And many more.
Yes, many more. But we look forward greatly to that book being published. Mm. Is there another character now that you might move on to?
Oh, no, I have to get this one out of the way. No,
yes.
Not rest.
Yes.
I mean, I'm proofreading the English text,
right,
but I'm also translating it into Chinese.
In my China Club, there is a huge calligraphy, which I bought from Christie's once, which was by Ji Xi herself, who was a very competent calligrapher.
Yes.
And I always find that very, very special, because anybody who does calligraphy like that could only have been an artist and had a refined mind and so forth.
She was an artist. Yes. By the way, can I come and take a picture of
that? Of course,
absolutely. Would you clear copyright?
Yes, of course, immediately.
Yes, all that needs to be done.
Yeah.
That's the chores of writing nonfiction, because you have to do extensive
Have you ever thought
notes.
Of doing a fiction?
No. And I think...
Facts
are strange. It's definitely. And also, I get enormous pleasure to get to the bottom of truth.
Well, at the Hong Kong Art Fair Forum, we will have two biographers. I mean, you, of course, with Wild Swan, Mao, and then Qi Xi, and William Shawcross on his subjects. And then we have a novelist. So we hope to balance things out. But we are looking enormously. Looking forward enormously to your coming to Hong Kong, and I know that there will be many people who will want to ask you questions, both about the way you write and how you write and what you write, but also the content of your book. And I'm, for one, very glad that you're coming to Hong Kong, because that is the one place where Chinese will be able to read everything you write. So, Yong, thank you very much, and we look forward to seeing you in Hong Kong.
Thank you. I'm really looking forward to it.
Good.
Thank you.